Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning. It is the 12th of May, and it's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Hope you are doing well on this fine day. The music you just heard is that of Lloyd Price, who passed away earlier this month, May 3rd, at the age of 88. He was a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer known as, yes, Mr. Personality, after his 1959 million-selling hit, and we'll be hearing his music this morning, and the playlist is posted online, as it always is, wamc.org. Let's get started. We have a wonderful group of, I was going to say contestants. It's like you're out for a prize or something. At the end, we'll see.
How about personalities?
There you go. We have a wonderful group of panelists on the program, and we certainly look forward to hearing from all of them this morning. WAMs, and speaking of Mr. Personality, Alan Chartok is here. Good morning. How are you?
Aren't you nice? But I have to say, Joe, that really did it for me. I mean, I was in my regular mood. And then all of a sudden, on comes that wonderful music.
My regular mood. What mood would that be, Alan? My regular mood.
I can't say at this time.
That's great. Well, hopefully there was an improvement, and then
you're good, ready to go.
Well, welcome as always. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Malia, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. I just got back from a 40-mile backpacking trek with the Adirondack Mountain Club and feeling fabulous.
Wow. Good for you. So where does 40 miles bring you in the Adirondacks?
It is a section of the Northville Placid Trail that goes throughout the Adirondacks, north to south. So it's really fantastic. We're so lucky to live where we do that. Yes. This is nearby and easily accessible.
Well, good for you.
Did you see a bear?
We saw lots of amazing birds and wildlife, but not any bears.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
We saw signs of bears, but not any. Actual living bears.
SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State senator and our good friend Terry Gibson. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here. I came a little late. Did you say something about prizes? Are there prizes today?
I introduced you all as contestants as if we were going to have some sort of blood sport and vote you off the island at the end. But yeah, I don't know. No prizes.
Oh.
No.
Oh, okay.
Look.
I just want to make sure I had the rules straight before we started.
Terry, isn't being on today's show a prize enough?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good answer.
What more could a person ask for?
That's right. Good answer. Good morning, everybody. A reminder to you all who are listening at home, you can join us in our discussion. We'd love to hear from you, as always. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll hear what's on your mind about what is going on. So, of course, the big international story, which is of great concern, is the violence between Israelis and Palestinians, which is escalating toward all-out war. You heard the BBC report just a moment ago. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians approached all-out war on Tuesday as rocket attacks on Israeli cities and airstrikes in the Gaza Strip killed dozens, injured hundreds, and left thousands of people on both sides cowering under day-long bombardments. Military officials in both camps girded for the battles to escalate further, with Israel calling up 8 battalions of reservists and deploying additional artillery batteries in the communities near Gaza that have become the front line of the confrontation. Militants from Hamas, which controls Gaza, and the Islamic Jihad group fired more than 500 rockets at towns in coastal and southern Israel, killing at least 2 in one port city and another in an adjoining city. Israelis across the part of the country, including much of the population of Tel Aviv, hustled into shelters or stairways as air raid sirens sounded again and again. Schools in much of southern Israel remain closed. Alan, obviously a very troubling situation, as it has been for decades, but how do you look at this morning?
Well, there are so many different ways of looking at it, Joe. There's the political way. This is obviously good for Netanyahu, who has always been seen as the leader who will defend Israel against the Arabs. And that's why he keeps getting reelected. I'm not saying that's proper. I'm just saying that's what it that is the basis of his politics and the politics of Israel. What's so important to me is just trying to find out exactly what happened here. We do know that there was a scuffle over the attempt by the Israelis to take over some more Arab lands, Arab-owned properties in Jerusalem. At least that's what I've read. And, of course, that may have been the match that set off the tinderbox this time. But on the other hand, there can be no excuse for sending rockets into Israel. And the American government has made that very, very plain. And it is, you know, for people like myself who are American Jews, you know, we have who are raised to worship Israel and what it was and carry little blue and white boxes around with us to collect money. This is a betrayal of the principle of a socialist Israel, which started that way and started on such a moral high ground, but is now called into question. Mm-hmm. So it isn't an easy one, and obviously this is a terrible situation for everybody.
Rosemary.
Well, as you know, I am a free Palestine person. My sympathies are solidly on the Arab side. I am disgusted today with America and with Israel. This is the result. What's happening right now has nothing to do with the fact that this is a century-old dispute, has nothing to do with the fact that Israel's existence was disputed up until about 1970. I think it's been decided since then, but we still hear about it. This has nothing to do with that. This is all about the last 5 years under the Trump-Kushner-Netanyahu plan, which was to crush Palestine, which was to turn its Arab allies into Israeli allies so that they could focus on Iran. And that has left the Palestinians completely desperate, willing to lob bombs at Israelis who this time, as they have in every other time when there's been a fight, have responded with excessive, almost terroristic response that's brought out condemnation by Amnesty International. And that is happening now. That is at our hands. Of course, Netanyahu loves this. It's distracting from his own legal and political problems. And again, it's casting him in the role of calling out the forces and looking like the savior. Israel does not need saving from the weak. They have nothing. Hamas has nothing. We're hearing the old tropes about Hamas is sending its bombs up from installations near civilians. I think all of that is propaganda that we listen to here. And we did this. All those people, the commentators, including on the roundtable, said, oh, isn't it great that Trump is getting sign-in from other Arabs to support Israel? No, it was all a distraction. It was all intended, I think, to bring about exactly what is happening right now, that Israel has the perfect excuse to go in and just kill and crush and end any Palestinian. And the provocation also provokes the hell out of me. The Arabs are making the comparison to, if it were for Christians, so you can understand it, if it were Christmas time and worshipers were in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican, and Italian troops moved in and began pushing them out, and then also began trying to get them to leave the neighborhoods around St. Peter's, and the Italians acted as if they were the victims of it. That's what's going on. That is how they see the dispute right now. And I, frankly, am having a hard time seeing it any other way.
Terry Gibson.
Well, this is a tough one. You know, I have friends that have family in Palestine, and I have friends that have family in Israel, and I hear both sides. And it's you know, as a person who lives in Hudson Valley, New York, it's sometimes hard to really get a grasp on what's really happening in a place that's so far away. And I think it's hard for so many Americans to really relate to and understand, partly because we haven't really done a good job of teaching world history in our public schools. But the thing that does stand out to me, and Rosemary, I think, hit on it, was that the way I read this is that the Trump administration's policy towards Israel and just towards the Middle East in general really just gave Netanyahu permission to do whatever he wanted to do, and without any accountability, without any checks and balances. And to me, I think this is really the result of that policy, to just make for a more aggressive leader of Israel for the time being. I remember there was a press conference between Netanyahu and Donald Trump maybe a year or two ago. I don't remember when it was exactly, but I do remember that someone asked Donald Trump, with Netanyahu on stage, what do you see, you know, what is your solution to the crisis between Palestine and Israel? And I remember Donald Trump saying to the press reporter right there, "I'm for doing whatever Netanyahu wants to do." And from that point on, it was pretty clear to me that we were going to be pushing towards a policy that just made Israel more aggressive towards Palestine.
Malia Dumont.
So I think that the Biden administration and others in the foreign policy establishment, even outside the administration, have been perhaps caught a little bit by surprise by this, but based on what Terry and Rosemary have just said, they shouldn't have been. I think there's been a lot of wishful thinking that has led to the Biden administration so far to take sort of a hands-off approach towards Israel and hope that they could focus on other priorities like China and foreign policy. And they've ignored the fact that there's been, you know, more extremist activity in Israel and sort of a rise of the right wing. But I don't think that's well understood, or as it's not as well understood as it should be. I mean, Foreign Policy magazine ran a piece last year saying that the right wing in Israel had peaked, and that that doesn't seem to be accurate based on what we're seeing now. So the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has talked to his counterpart in Israel every day this week. Tony Blinken has talked to his counterpart. And I think, you know, this is what has happened in some previous administrations as well, where they hope that they're going to be able to focus on other foreign policy priorities. And then something happens in the Middle East. The tensions there don't go away, even if you have some wishful thinking that they will. And then they get pulled back into focusing on this. So I don't know that the Biden administration has a lot of good choices in front of it, which is why we're just hearing them say, sort of.
Oh, we lost Malia.
Oh, well, our phone service lately, Joe, has not.
No, there she is. There she is. Okay, go ahead. Malia, just for a second. Your last sentence there we lost, but go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think the Biden administration has a lot of good choices in front of it. And that's why I think that, you know, they've been saying sort of neutral statements like we condemn violence, but they're treading gingerly, and I think they'll probably continue to do so.
Alan, your thought on what many have said about the Trump administration and their hand in this?
Well, there's no doubt that, and it disgusted me, to be honest with you, that Netanyahu and Trump were joined at the hip. That should not, of course, make this into something more simplistic than it is. But it is something to consider that, you know, Netanyahu was brought over here. I believe he talked to a joint session of Congress.
Yeah.
Trump had a setup. You know, this is something that has to be negotiated at every turn. That while those of us who have always believed in Israel as a place where the Jews went after the Holocaust, which was terribly important, I can only say that we have to be very careful about how we proceed here. Now, the politics of the nation are that the Biden administration immediately came out with a forceful defense of Israel. And I think that's very important to understand that that's the politics of the nation, too.
So I would like to talk about that. We only have about we just about have to go to a break. So I'll set this up and then we'll talk about it on the other side. But President Biden had hoped to shift foreign policy focus away from the Middle East, and this conflict is obviously forcing him to get involved. And there is an article in the Times this morning about this stand-back approach. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that when we return in just a few minutes. We welcome your letters. We're getting several. We'll get to all of them when we come back. Well, all of the ones that we can get to, let's put it that way. And we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. You probably heard the breaking news that was just announced on the BBC, but as we were going to break, it was officially announced that House Republicans have ousted Representative Liz Cheney from her post as the chamber's number three GOP leader, punishing her after she repeatedly rebuked former President Donald Trump for his false claims of election fraud and his role in fomenting the January 6th Capitol attack. Meeting behind closed doors for less than 20 minutes, GOP lawmakers used a voice vote to remove Cheney from the party's number three position. She has been Congress's highest ranking Republican woman and is, of course, daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Meanwhile, Elise Stefanik has sent out a letter. She did not wait for the corpse to grow cold. She wrote immediately asking members of the House Republican Conference Committee to earn their vote for House Republican Conference Chair. So that is all going on right now, as we say. Also, the president, former president of the United States, Donald Trump, issued a statement just seconds ago that said, "Liz Cheney is a bitter, horrible human being. I watched her yesterday and realized how bad she is for the Republican Party. She has no personality or anything good having to do with politics in our country. She is a talking point for Democrats, whether that means the border, the gas lines, inflation, or destroying our economy." So, with that, I know we were talking about Israel, and I do want to get to that topic. But as this is breaking, and since we have discussed this a great deal, we can probably just get your comments on it, and then we can move back to the Israeli-Palestinian story. Alan.
Well, I don't know what to say, except that we've said it all. The Republicans are committing political suicide. This is a party which is needed in the United States. It's important to have discussion, and it is important in order to have a democracy to have two sides. You know which one I'm on. Nevertheless, I think it's terribly important that we continue to have a viable Republican Party. And I think they're committing political suicide. I don't have any doubt about it. When you add up all the numbers and you see Trump's approval rating in the 30s and you see Biden's in the mid-60s, almost mid-60s, it's an incredible plus for the Democratic Party. And yet, because the individual senators and congressmen are so worried about Trump coming out against them and endorsing a primary opponent, they do what Republicans across the country are not necessarily doing. They are committing political suicide. And their number as a result will go smaller and smaller, even though within that conference, they're patting each other on the back.
Malia Dumont.
Well, I agree with Alan's general sentiment that this should constitute some sort of political suicide, but I don't think, unfortunately, there's a straight line between this and political problems for Republicans, partly because of what they're doing with regard to gerrymandering and restricting voting rights. So the declining Republican support in various places around the country is not necessarily going to immediately translate into fewer votes for Republicans because of the way they're trying to change access to voting. And I'm deeply concerned about that.
But Malia, don't you think there is a real problem here in that they are not looking at the larger picture of independents who will desert them?
You're absolutely
right about everything you said. Look, I've talked about this for 3 days straight now, the gerrymander and the voting repression and what they're trying to do in order to rig, in in Trump's words, or steal the election. That's what they're trying to do. And yet we see how terrible the results could be for them, even because there are a lot of independent Americans who really won't like what's going on.
Yeah, and not just independent Americans. I agree. I have a lot of moderate Republican friends, too, and they really feel disenfranchised right now. Some of them, I was shocked to hear from one of my friends who's from a family, like a blue blood family in Virginia. They've been Republican since they came over on the Mayflower, basically. And he has switched his party affiliation to Democrat and also plans to run for office as a Democrat. He feels that strongly that he's been abandoned by the Republican Party. Others who are in that same sort of center-right space, I think, are struggling. And not everyone wants to switch party affiliation. And also not everyone wants to stand up the way Liz Cheney did. You know, I disagree with a lot of her policies, but I respect what she's done. But it, obviously she's paying a price for it, and not everyone wants to do that.
Terry Gibson.
Well, you know, the current message that the Republicans have come up with for why they've taken this move today is that they want to move forward and not live in the past anymore and focus on the future. And of course, it's going to be interesting to see how that works out, because Donald Trump is going to continue to refuse to let them live in the future because he wants to rehash the past every second that he can. So I'm not sure how well that's going to work out. But on the other hand, I do hesitate to think that this is political suicide for the Republicans, because I think that they have calculated that with the tens of millions of people that still support Donald Trump, and with the gerrymandering that they can now do because they control most of the state legislatures, I think that they have calculated that they have a really good chance of taking back the House if they can continue to move forward with Donald Trump's support. And I think most of what's happening right now is all about taking back the House, and hopefully the Senate if they can do it too. They're not focused on the presidential election yet, because that's a little further away. And so we have a long way to go before we get to that. I think in the short term, this move is going to help them take back the House, and it's going to make it harder for Democrats to defeat them. And that greatly disturbs me.
Rosemary.
Well, I don't think it's suicide, as I've already said, I think, before in previous programs. I think this is calculated to when they win back the House, which they are estimating that they will, and they may well be right, that they will be in a position to control elections going forward. I think it's part of a concerted long-term effort that also involves putting judges in who will give them the right decisions, putting state legislatures in place that will not certify votes, and taking over House leadership where the Electoral College certifications took place. And the next time it happens, as it did in 2020, I think it could very well go a different way, so that Republicans will continue to win, even if they don't have the support of the masses, which I don't think they do, but that doesn't matter in America, in our system. The one thing that could change this is that Cheney and others, some 100 top Republicans, are talking about breaking away and forming another party. Third parties don't work in the U.S., but that would divide the Republican vote and maybe put Democrats in. And the other thing that we ought to be paying attention to is, come on, how did Elise Stefanik happen? She was up for an election in the last year, and Democrats put up a weak candidate, a woman who had already lost to Stefanik, who made missteps from the very beginning and didn't even put up a fight. Democrats have to take every congressional race seriously, which they have not done up to now, starting with Stefanik.
I just want to move on to the many, many letters we have on the fighting between Israelis and Palestinians. And I do want to, but I want to make mention of the fact that about Liz Cheney's remarks that she made last night, that the president, former president, referred to. In those remarks, Ms. Cheney urged Republicans not to, quote, let the former president drag us backward, according to a person familiar with the private comments who detailed them on condition of anonymity. Ms. Cheney warned that Republicans were going down a path that would bring their destruction and possibly the destruction of our country, adding that if the party wanted a leader who would enable and spread his destructive lies, they should vote to remove her. And as we reported they did just that. They greeted her speech with boos, according to two people present, and they ultimately opted not to hold a recorded vote after Representative Kevin McCarthy of California said that they should vote by voice to show their unity in that situation. Emerging from the meeting, Ms. Cheney remained unremorseful and said she was committed to doing everything I can to ensure that the former president never again gets near the Oval Office. So, with that, let us turn back to where we were on the story about the very concerning issue and violence that is taking place. Matt writes to us and says, as someone who spent time in both Israel proper and in East Jerusalem, Hebron, and other Palestinian areas, I can tell you firsthand of the justified frustration of Palestinians. It's an apartheid situation there. Karen, you can't call the bombardment, displacement, murder, and ethnic cleansing of Palestine a scuffle. This is not a war. Palestine has no military, while Israel has the 11th strongest military in the world. Time to reorganize the Palestinians' right to exit. Please jump in if you would like to say something.
I agree with all of this. I've been to those places, too. I've worked in Palestinian-held areas, and I think that it's part of the misunderstanding that we have in the United States as Israeli allies of what's really going on. It's much more like the white settlers in America against the Native Americans. There is no – they are right to – settlers were right to think that the Indians, if I can use that out of term, out of popularity expression, but the Indians did have evil intent towards them and so responded with force and violence. But there's just such a disparity between the two forces that it just is not comparable. So Hamas lobs rockets because it has, or the people throw stones, the revolts and Palestinians in Jerusalem and in Israel have been with stones. It's completely outclassed. They have no hope of winning. This is an act of a desperate and oppressed people. And what's going on in Israel is not defense of their borders. It's oppression of people inside their borders. And the fact that I'm expressing this is not anti-Semitic. I am not anti-Jewish. I am anti-Netanyahu. And that is a big difference that gets blurred in America.
We do have this from Ed, who said, Rosemary is again a reliable shill for the Palestinians. There have been many times where the Palestinians could have had their own state, but their leadership finds it more convenient to receive the millions of dollars in refugee aid. By the way, Rosemary, no tears for Israelis injured in the rocket attacks? Question mark.
I have tears for any child hurt in this needless violence. And as for the refugee aid, that was cut off by Trump. The Trump and Kushner plan was to reduce all help for Palestine, to force them to agree to an Israeli-directed peace plan. That was rejected out of hand, and it leaves us now. It leaves Biden. We talked about how he's tried to push off to something else. Why would he not? We are in no position to be a mediator anymore, as we have been since World War II. We have been the international mediator in that dispute. We cannot do that anymore because of what Trump did.
Alicia takes Terry to task and saying it's ridiculous to say that public schools are to blame for Americans not knowing much about the Israel and Palestine conflict. Overgeneralizations like this perpetuate ignorance. American culture on the whole has never focused on many different aspects of international history, more likely due to implicit biases rather than the work of educators. Maybe if Terry fully funded foundation aid in the state when he was in office, New York's public schools would have the resources to offer alternative history classes that focus on this topic. Terry, would you like to respond?
Well, I did vote to fully fund foundation aid when I was in office, but I happened to be in the minority at the time, and so we weren't able to get that passed. Fortunately, Democrats are in the majority now, and things like that are getting to happen. I do think that we could do a much better job of teaching world history in public schools. That's not to say that there aren't schools that are doing that, but I think that the average American's knowledge about international affairs is still very weak. And at times like this, it makes it difficult for us to have a productive conversation.
Israel writes that as an American Jew, child of a Holocaust survivor and supporter of Israel, I can't begin to express my outrage in the attacks on Israel and the callous international response. The ongoing goal of Israel's foe is the elimination of Israel, and the fact transcends the swings of change in American administrations. I have a lot of family in Israel that I'm concerned about. With all due respect to roundtable participants, Israel is the only true democracy in that troubled region, and in my view, it is essential to show support for her in this very difficult time. We have many more letters, so let me hold them because we have to take a break. We're late. We'll take that break and we'll finish up this hour with more letters. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Malia Dumont, and Terry Gibson making up our panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we have quite a few, and we'll be doing these up until the top of the hour. And again, panel, if you have anything to add or would like to jump in, please do so. Let's see. We go to Harleen. Israel went politically from a left-wing country to now politically a right-wing religious country. But don't forget, it is situated in the Middle East among the very religious Arab countries. Karen says, this morning's panel is the second time I have heard Trump credited with inviting Netanyahu to speak before Congress. The guilty party was actually John Boehner, who did it during the Obama administration, which made it all the more egregious.
I guarantee you, you know, if Trump had been opposed to it, it wouldn't have happened. Clearly, this was part of the Trump-Netanyahu alliance.
We also go to Deborah. I'm Jewish. I support Israel's right to exist, but the continued appropriation of Palestinian land and homes for settlers reminds me of Poles and Hungarians, etc., who couldn't wait until their Jewish neighbors were carted off to take over their property. It is a violation of international law. Let's remember who's really backing the aggressive Israeli government policy, says John, towards the Palestinians, American fundamentalist Christians. But this isn't my opinion. Back in the early 2000s, a former member of the Reagan administration stated flat out, quote, if it weren't for American evangelicals carrying water for Israel, it wouldn't exist. Basically, our foreign policy is the U.S. by the U.S. is driven by what one sect of U.S. Christianity wants.
Joe, if I could just jump in, I think that's a great letter. And I think it also just points to what's happening in the Republican Party today, and especially what happened with Liz Cheney's being excommunicated today. These things are related. The Republican Party today understands that they have to also address the desires of that evangelical Christian base that supports Donald Trump. And they are adamantly pro-Israel in a way that I would consider to be extreme and are really not interested in anything to do with compromise or negotiations. And I think these two things are very related. So I just think it's a really good letter.
While you are on the floor, Carolyn writes, right on, Mr. Gibson. RIP American democracy, even as flawed as we are. Debbie says, I agree with Rosemary. It's Trump's fault. He set this in motion. Mike writes to us and says, as a Jewish American growing up in the late 60s and 70s, I share the memories Alan spoke of regarding Israel. Like Alan, I am torn. I cannot understand why a two-state solution has not been brokered years ago. Two peaceful neighbors benefiting from each other's economy sounds like a good thing to me. Samaya says, thank you, Rosemary, for your opinion on what's happening in Palestine. It's so frustrating to see and read how Israel under Netanyahu is land grabbing with no word about the Palestinian rights. Even with COVID vaccines, Israelis first and then maybe the Palestinians. It is sad. It is shameful. Dee says,
yeah, it is. And we continue to pose this as Israel defending its borders. They're not defending. They are oppressing a people within what is now their borders. Used to be their territory. This is all goes back to the British, who in answer to Zionist demands and also anti-Semitism. The British want to get rid of Jews, too. All your unwanted Jews, just ship them out to the far-off, remote Middle East. So they set up Israel, set up a situation where they're under attack from neighbors. Israel settled that decades ago. I can't believe I'm still hearing from people about the Yom Kippur War and how they have to defend. What policy of ours from the 1960s do we still refer to regularly? It is a distraction from what is going on right now. And Netanyahu has, he is Trump. He is Trump in the Middle East. He was promoted by Trump. He is corrupt in the same way. And he has ruthlessly mined an old religious and deeply held land dispute into what we're seeing now. And children are dying because of it. So blame Hamas. I'm not defending. Well, I'm pro-Palestinian, but I'm not pro-Palestinian leadership. There's lots of blame there. But on the whole, when you look at this, I do not understand how we come out supporting the Netanyahu administration.
So what is the end game here in the sense of what we're going to see over the next several days? What's the goal, do you think?
The goal of who?
Well,
in other words, how will it come out?
Yeah, how do you think it'll come out?
I think it's an extremely dangerous situation. There has not been this level of violence in 20 years. The Biden administration has no traction whatsoever because of the Trump administration, because they're so new themselves. I am very worried. And Jordan is weak right now. They just had a political crisis of their own. And I don't know anyone who has. I think Netanyahu is going to get away with it. I think we're going to see large death, and then Israel will support Netanyahu, and he'll get the government he has been unable to get through, what, four elections now and 2 years of trying.
Alan, right before...
Yeah, well, there are parts of what Rosemary just said that I don't agree with. Not what she just said, but some of the position. But I do say I agree with her. I think that in the end, this is good for Netanyahu. I said so earlier today. And he will, of course, come charging out and say, I'm the one who's going to protect you from these Arabs. And it's going to work and redound to his political favorability. You going to say, Joe? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask right before we got, for want of a better term, interrupted by the Liz Cheney story. We were talking about the president, President Biden's stance on this, a stand back approach of what he wanted. And now the violence in Israel, of course, challenges that approach. And while he came to office seeing little opportunity to resolve the conflict, now perhaps forced to get more involved. What do you make of that situation, Alan? And how does that tie into how this plays out?
Well, first of all, between I often ask my classes what percentage of America are Jewish, and they come up with wild estimates like 50%. It's, it's less than 2%. But the country and the evangelicals and a lot of people stand with Israel. There's no question about it, which is why you will find Biden doing the same thing. He is not going to upset that apple cart, that's for sure. Others have tried it, and it hasn't worked. So politically, it hasn't worked. So that's what I'm thinking. I think in the end, it will go away, as it always goes away, and it will continue to have flare-ups, that's for sure.
Malia?
Yeah, I think Biden came into office, and he has reversed a lot of what Trump has done in various areas of policy, but not so much on the Israeli side. And so Biden's policy towards Israel is actually much closer to Trump's than it is in a lot of other areas. And it's not as easy to reverse as it is in areas like environmental policy, where Biden has been trying to roll back some of what Trump put in place. So there are a lot of ways that the Biden administration is much more pro-Israel than any of his Democratic predecessors, and is not engaging with the Palestinians in a way that's similar to how Obama did. So I just think that's important for people to realize that, think Biden wanted to avoid this and hoped that it would go away and hoped that he wouldn't have to spend a lot of time and attention on this issue, and that sort of slowly moving forward would be fine. But clearly that's not the case. And there are a lot of reasons for Netanyahu as well, electoral politics, that that he's not going to lessen his approach towards the Palestinians. And I think Biden's caught in a situation where there's some legal things in place now that weren't in place under Obama that Trump put in place that make it hard for him to take a more balanced approach.
I have one more letter before we go to a break at the top of the hour here, and that's from Dee. The proclamations of the Biden administration in favor of human rights ring hollow when one observes that it is American weaponry that is being used in the slaughter of women and children in Gaza by the Israeli apartheid state. That from Dee. We'll pause there on this subject and go to a break at the top of the... What'd you say? I'm sorry.
I'm just laughing at the temperate language of that letter.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, chief of staff and vice president for strategy and policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, and SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson, all with us this morning. So just want to play cleanup with some of the letters before we move on to other topics. Bob writes to us and says, Biden may not be able to force Trump-centric Netanyahu to tamp down the violence, but remember that he can reverse Trump's move to the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. That threat would have real resonance. Then we go to Harry, who says the right-wing religious evangelicals in the U.S. have a policy goal to bring on the rapture. Then we go to more political stories. This on Liz Cheney. This letter from Dave has a subject line of whitewashing Liz Cheney. The connect the dots context is overlooked. This is the GOP that Liz Cheney and her dreadful father strove relentlessly to create for decades. Never let up on that. The GOP is and has been Trump, and Trump is the GOP. No daylight between them at all. Then Mike says it is overdue for the media to acknowledge that the Republican Party is not a legitimate electoral party. They do not believe in democracy. They do not just want to funnel as much money as possible. To the rich. They are now the party of dictatorship, and it seems evident that they are following the directives of their right-wing billionaire funders like the Kochs and Mercers to create a country where the results of elections can be controlled by them. Yes. And then this letter for you, Alan, a question from Rick. Should I change my party affiliation to allow me to vote in the next Republican primary in a way that benefits non-Trumpian candidates, so to dilute the irrational Trumpian ability to sway Congress?
Is there a signature, a place on this? See, in Massachusetts, if you register as an independent, you can take, which I do, you can, for non-enrolled, not an independent, right, but non-enrolled, you can take a ballot in either party during primary time. So if the writer is calling from Massachusetts, not necessary, just register as non-enrolled. On the other hand, if in New York, and I've never quite understood this, the powers that be have always wanted to imprison their people. So you don't get that choice. And if you are in New York State, you are going to have to choose to register either the Republican or the Democratic Party. And there the question is relevant. And I can't give you advice because you have to decide how important it is.
Right. And no geography attached to that letter. We move on to other topics here, and we'll go to the NRA story. Federal judge denying the NRA attempt to declare bankruptcy in a win for the New York State Attorney General. A federal judge Tuesday denied an effort by the National Rifle Association to file for bankruptcy protection, ruling that the gun rights group had filed the case in a bad faith attempt to fend off a lawsuit by the New York Attorney General. The court, quote, the court finds, based on the totality of the circumstances, that the NRA's bankruptcy petition was not filed in good faith, but instead was filed as an effort to gain an unfair litigation advantage in the NYAG enforcement action and as an effort to avoid a regulatory scheme. Those were the words written by Judge Harlan Hale in his 37-page decision. The decision was a victory for New York Attorney General Letitia James, who filed a far-reaching civil suit against the group last August, accusing top officials of fraud and self-dealing. Alan.
Well, you know, no question that this is a serious setback for the NRA. Part of the dark music in the background has to do with the fact that LaPierre, the head guy, has obviously been living fairly high on the hog, at least according to some of these accusations. So it will be in New York. It'll stay in New York as an incorporation. And the Attorney General has won a major victory, as you say.
Terry Gibson.
Well, nothing makes me happier than to see bad things happen to the NRA. I mean, I can't hide it. I'm sorry.
No tears.
I mean, this is an organization that I think has done great damage to our country and continues to do so. I do think that their credibility is waning and that their days may be numbered. But on the other hand, I think that they have probably accomplished much of what they set out to accomplish, and that they have successfully advocated and successfully seen so many pro-gun laws passed in so many states across this country that thanks to the NRA, we now have a ridiculous amount of guns and accessibility to guns in our country, and we see the results of that every day. And we're going to need to get more people elected at all levels of government that believe that we need to roll back some of these laws if we ever hope to change it, whether the NRA stays in business or not.
LaPierre acknowledged the loss in a statement posted to the group's Twitter account, but the embattled NRA leader vowed the group would continue to, quote, confront our adversaries. Rosemary.
Why is LaPierre still in there? Why has the NRA not dumped him? He set off out to move out of New York State without informing anybody on the board. He's been involved in this disastrous lawsuit, made more disastrous by a loss that was easily predictable, according to anybody who knows about bankruptcy law. And there have been revelations, which he also was responsible for letting out. He didn't even hide it well because he brought a lawsuit in which it allowed discovery. So his lavish lifestyle that he's been living off people's dues, even this lawsuit itself, which was completely frivolous. So my question is, why does the NRA still have him in power? They are losing influence. They would not necessarily be losing influence because it still has a lot of support if they had a better leader. I think he is a huge liability.
And I know this was going to sound extra snarky, but it is the truth. But their other option was Oliver North.
Yeah. Well, at least he has an international following, and I don't think he was like having himself driven around in chauffeured limousines and flying first class and that other sort of just, you know, wasting money. It has nothing to do with your stand on guns. It's just if you're in that organization, is that how you want your money being spent?
Right. Malia.
Yeah, well, Wayne LaPierre is clearly a crook. But to try to answer Rosemary's question, which is a very good one, you know, why hasn't the membership of the NRA stood up and said, let's get rid of this guy? I think partly it's because the NRA has been so effective at the local and state level. And so membership perhaps doesn't care, or they're not as aware as they should be. Like what they hear from the NRA is about all the success that they're having legislatively in various states across the country. And so this news that Wayne LaPierre has some kind of, you know, lawsuit against him, I'm sure that a lot of the members think that it's politically motivated, and some of them would probably just dismiss it and not care that much. So The people who are keeping him in power internally, they probably, a lot of them don't see that this is much of a negative. And I also, I just start thinking back to the era of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, where, you know, it's a similar kind of organization where people at
I'm
the
glad
top.
Glad we could remember that this morning.
You know, using money that the faithful gave to live a lavish lifestyle. And even after they were discovered, a lot of their supporters kept sending in money. And I think there are some parallels.
Anybody else on that, Alan?
Well, there's a lot of parallels. There's a lot of parallels to everything that she just said. There's a lot of parallels to how the Republican Party has been operating lately as well, with all of the people that have given
Absolutely.
Donald Trump money thinking it was going to be used for something beyond just his own personal needs. And, you know, most of the money that he's been given is now being used to defend him in lawsuits.
I was going to add 73 million people voted for, voted for Trump.
Yeah.
So when you talk about who's drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, there's no surpassing that with all of his dictatorial utterances and everything else that the guy has said. You know, that's where we are. And people are willing to look the other way in so many different areas.
And the other the other comparison to the NRA and the Republican Party, and it was just touched on, is that the NRA did successfully organize at a very grassroots level at state, local, town, villages, and that has given them a lot of strength. And that's exactly the same pattern that the Republican Party followed, is that they understood how important it was decades ago to start getting Republicans elected to every single office from dog catcher all the way up to president, Congress, state legislatures, and it's why they now have so much power in this country. It's not because there are more Republicans in the country than Democrats. It's because they've gotten more Republicans elected to local offices than Democrats. And Democrats are really, really suffering from that right now.
On that,
by the way, I absolutely agree with you, because the power in this case, for example, in gerrymandering and everything, is with the state legislatures. On the other hand, you got a Democratic president, a Democratic governor in New York State. You got two houses of Congress, which are marginally, and I do say marginally, controlled by the Democrats. So, Terry, for all of their trying and all of their trying to rearrange the deck chairs, they're going down. They're going down.
I hope you're right. I'll be there to salute them as they go.
Kathleen writes, my hunch is that the higher ups at the NRA these days care very little about gun rights. They use this issue to get money and power, and that's what it's all about for them. They manipulated ignorant people, as Republicans do. That from Kathleen. All right. We'll move on to other subjects in the 8 or 9 minutes that we have before our break at the bottom of the hour. And of course, we've been talking a lot about the Colonial Pipeline and their work to restore service after the cyber attack that was reported as of Friday. So now we're seeing fuel shortages cropping up in the Southeast. Gas prices are climbing after the pipeline attack. Lines of panicked drivers overwhelmed gas stations in the Southeast on Tuesday as rising prices fed fears of shortages in the aftermath of a ransomware attack that forced the nation's largest fuel pipeline. In Atlanta, one of every five gas stations was reported to be out of fuel on Tuesday evening. A plumber who had driven from Myrtle Beach to Wilmington, North Carolina, said, "Look how crazy we're all getting over every little thing." And yet he made the drive anyway and saw long lines at every service station on the road.
I admit it. 8 o'clock this morning, I got in my car and I ran over to
our local station in
Great Barrington.
You told me when I talked to you, you said, "I'm going to go get gas." And I was like, oh.
Yes. And there was nobody there.
Basically. Yeah, no, yeah.
They were there, but it wasn't
a panic.
Happening.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
In Washington, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said the Southeast can expect a crunch that will take several days to alleviate. "We have gasoline," she said during a White House briefing. "We just have to get it to the right places, and that's why I think the next couple of days will be challenging." She said Colonial Pipeline officials had told her that a decision on a full restart could come as soon as this morning, the Colonial Pipeline system, which moves about 45% of the East Coast's fuel, shut down last Friday after hackers thought to be based in the former Soviet Union infiltrated servers and encrypted its data, demanding a fee to restore access. The Homeland Security Secretary, who was at the White House briefing, said American organizations have lost more than $350 million this year as a result of ransomware attacks. Alan, anything more you'd like to say on that before I go?
No, it is so confusing on that, because we know that they should be paying off, that blackmail is a bad thing. As pointed out on yesterday's panel, it is not against the law to pay off. Apparently, it's not against the law to pay off. One would think that, you know, aiding in a criminal enterprise might be, but no. And a lot of people apparently pay off. They say, we can't afford not to go forward with this. I find that very troubling.
Rosemary. All right. No, Rosemary, we will go to...
I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
I'm
go
here.
Ahead.
I don't know what happened. I just wish I had a son or a spouse who was expert enough that they could undo the encryption, because you could get even more money doing that. You know, pay the good guys to undo the encryption of the bad guys. It's like a whole new economic opportunity opening up. So that's it. I don't understand how the bad guys can figure out how to encrypt in a way that, you know, people who work for Microsoft or Apple can't undo. So, again, it's because I don't understand that stuff.
I missed that joke.
Yeah, I can't. We're losing you, Rosemary. I don't know why.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Hacked.
Yeah. Been hacked mid-sentence. Just say what your last sentence there is what we missed.
No, the other thing I'm doing is trying to figure out how you can safely hoard gasoline. I hoarded toilet paper, and I'm feeling the same need to do this, but I don't want it like a whole bunch of flammable liquid in my garage.
You were a tuna hoarder, too, weren't you?
Well, what about that big pool in your backyard? Can't you empty that out and fill it up with gasoline?
Yeah. Be a scene out of the Flintstones. Malia, your thoughts?
Well, this pipeline is clearly a piece of our nation's critical infrastructure, and over 80% of critical infrastructure in the United States is owned by the private sector, which creates challenges. I mean, part of the good thing about that is that it's not centrally managed, and so just imagine if hackers got into a centrally managed system and disabled the entire country's pipelines. But it is it does create a lot of vulnerabilities. The government doesn't always have a clear view into what those vulnerabilities are. But there is a little known agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which I believe is part of the Department of Homeland Security. And they work very closely with all the owners of this 80% of critical infrastructure across the country to do reports, to offer vulnerability assessments, and also to do exercises. So I imagine there will be some kind of congressional hearing looking into not only this, but also the recent hack into the solar farm in Texas, I believe, that happened last month. There'll be hearings looking at, what kind of exercises have been done. Because when the government does an exercise, they imagine something like this happening, or they should have. You know, what happens if the Colonial Pipeline gets taken out? You know, what are the next steps? How do we get it online, reestablished pretty quickly? So I would want to know, I think the public should have a better understanding of what some of those exercises have been.
This should it be against the law, Malia, to pay off?
Oh, that's... I don't want to give a blanket response. I mean, there are some circumstances in which the risks of paying off may be less than trying to hold out. So some kind of template and parameters should definitely be developed so that you could go through a process of determining, what the actual risks are with paying off. So I'm not in favor of blackmail, obviously. I wouldn't want to take any option off the table at this point.
But it is extortion, and just as it's not a crime to pay off a blackmailer or a kidnapper, how can it be a crime to pay money when there is no way to legitimately get back your data? If you can't run your business without the data that is being held captive, a law making it illegal to do that would force you to go out of business in many cases. We have to figure out the technology here to either I don't know. I don't know how you can make it a criminal act to want your business back.
This is the mental gymnastics that were happening in my head this morning as I was driving in. But, and I realize that this is a very shaggy thought, so I declare that at the beginning of what I'm about to say. But so a meteorologist in this region comes on and says we could be getting 3 to 5 inches of snow, and there's a possibility that the storm could track north and we'll get 1 to 2 feet. And then good luck finding bread. You go in the store and there's no bread, there's no milk. The stores are just wiped out. And that's sort of how what we're seeing here, even with the gas. And I get it. And yet we can't get people vaccinated. I don't understand that. Like, people want to take care of themselves, and yet only to a point. All right.
Well,
I shut down the show.
I guess
shut down the show.
Just trying to help
a believer.
I'm
a believer. It should be mandatory. I think everybody should have to get vaccinated in order to save the country. I said it yesterday. I think Rosemary took the same line. Maybe I'm wrong. Rosemary, did you agree with that?
Yeah, you agreed. I think you
agree. No, I agree. I think that you should be held accountable for actions you take that impede on the public health or the rights of other people. And not getting vaccinated is a clear and present danger to the rest of us. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out what it is in us that says, okay, well, I want to store nuts for the winter, and yet I don't want to do this thing that can keep me safe. Like, I don't want to starve to death. I want to make sure I have plenty of gas so I can go to the store. Yes, Rosemary?
Yes,
Rosemary. I'm sorry, I lost you all for a while.
Oh.
How many million people voted for Trump?
Yeah, well, that's,
It's 74 million, yes.
It's a Talmudic way of answering your question.
I agree, but those
question with a question.
But the 73 million people are also many of the people who are going to get gas, right? I mean, that's where I sort of the disconnect comes. I made far too much of this. I apologize. Go ahead.
I think partly it's prioritizing the individual over community too. I mean, you don't want
there
to be
you
hungry
go. There's
yourself.
An answer.
That's something. That's something you yourself will suffer. A lot of people aren't necessarily afraid of getting sick, or they don't think they will. But a lot of the reasoning for getting vaccinated isn't just about your own health. It's about community health. And that's not something that's easily understood or compelling to a lot of people.
Well,
not the same way individual personal hunger is, certainly.
Well, thank you for playing our game. You're a fine contestant on our program, and I appreciate it.
Right. There's no prizes. No prizes.
We'll work out something later. We have to take a break, and we will do that. And when we come back, we'll have our last round with our panel, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Malia Dumont, and Terry Gibson. We welcome your letters for our final segment, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning, the 12th of May. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Malia Dumont, and Terry Gibson making up the panel. We welcome your letters for our last call this morning. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Happening right now, the two men who were in charge of the Pentagon and Justice Department on January 6 are defending their response to the pro-Trump riot despite rampant criticism that the National Guard took far too long to arrive after insurrectionists breached the Capitol. Christopher Miller, who was the acting defense secretary at the time, is telling members of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform right now that he stands by, quote, every decision I made that day. that according to prepared remarks obtained by the Washington Post, and that any criticism of the National Guard's response, quote, reflects inexperience with or a lack of understanding of the nature of military operations, or worse, that it's simply the result of politics. The defiance stands for Miller probably will rankle Democrats on the panel, who are expected to demand a reckoning from the former officials, particularly Miller. Security collapsed in the face of the mob, and reinforcements were delayed for hours as the Capitol was overrun, panel chairwoman Carolyn Maloney said this morning. It is clear that despite all of the intelligence, the federal government was not prepared. Today, more than 4 months later, we're still in the dark about exactly what went wrong. The panel's audience with Miller and former acting attorney general Jeffrey Rosen marks the first time that either has spoken publicly with lawmakers about the events of January 6th. Alan.
I hope somebody's going to ask him the question, did you hear from the White House before you did anything or didn't do something? Yeah, you know, come on, this is crazy. The idea here is that we saw what happened, and in order to put a stop to it, they could have used their muscle, their political muscle, their technical muscle, and everything else to stop it. They didn't do it. And it is so clear that this is exactly what Trump wanted. You know, people were calling him and begging him and crying, his own people, and he wasn't doing a thing. His own vice president, remember him? Mike Pence was theoretically being followed by people who were saying, get him. And there was a gallows outside to hang him on. I don't know that they were going to do it, but that's the case. So the idea that these foolish people, otherwise known as fools, would be out there still defending what they did is incredible. And I just hope that they will get the most important things. I think in Mr. Roberts, it was a question of saying, answering a direct question.
Yes. Malia.
Well, I'm sure that the Department of Defense is not blameless in this, but neither are they completely to blame. And so I just want to clarify a couple things. The Department of Defense cannot decide on its own to send in the National Guard anywhere. That is against the law. And so part of the problem here, and I think that came out in the hearings earlier, is that the domestic law enforcement agencies told the Pentagon in advance that they didn't think they would need the support. So the National Guard can mobilize quickly if there's a mission in advance. You know, they can't just show up in 5 minutes. That's not the way it works. And they are always in support of civil authorities. The civil authorities are the ones that have to request them. They have to identify the mission. They have to define what is needed. And that is something that came out very clearly in the hearings, that some of the law enforcement agencies didn't think they would need any National Guard support, and the Defense Department checked in with them multiple times. Are you sure you're not going to need anything? And the response came back, no, we don't need anything. So I think there's a cascading effect here, and it's also exacerbated by the fact that there's this extremely complicated patchwork of agencies between the Capitol Police and the DC Metropolitan Police, and maybe they haven't done enough exercises for this kind of contingency. Clearly, there were a lot of things that fell through the cracks, and things were not handed off smoothly and cleanly. It's very difficult to do that, which is why exercises in advance are so important. And I think they probably they clearly weren't prepared.
Yeah, but Malia, you know, do you not, that this president didn't want action there, that he was being implored to send people there, and he was sitting there apparently laughing and watching television during this time, and one and one makes two. So that while you're absolutely right, I'm sure, and you know exactly what you're talking about, that there are reasons that the National Guard couldn't act on its own. I think the message was delivered.
I think that the would have happened whether or not, I don't know whether Donald Trump intervened directly in this situation. But whether he did or not, I think there would have been a delay. I don't think that was the deciding factor here.
Miller testified that responsibility to call up the D.C. National Guard had been delegated to him by President Donald Trump well in advance of January 6th, and that he had resisted Mayor Muriel Bowser's early calls to deploy those troops, despite intending to do so. Quote, until the concept of the operation, the plan was finalized, end quote. He also said that he was wary of the National Guard being pilloried or made to look like they were trampling on the demonstrators' First Amendment rights after the backlash to how federal law enforcement responded to the summer 2020 demonstration protesting the murder of George Floyd. Rosemary.
Well, these hearings are proceeding in a way that I predicted, that we're going to end up saying, and Malia, you went along with this, oh, they need more training, they need more resources, so we're going to throw it in. I personally don't know what kind of training you need to get that if you have a horde of thousands of chanting mobsters heading towards the Capitol, that maybe you ought to have a force out there. But anyway, that's easy and politically easy to do, and so that will happen. And instead, the real changes that could really protect us, I don't think we'll ever do. And that includes statehood for D.C. so that you have actual city officials who would be making the call or would be talking with the National Guard instead of or the Department of Defense instead of the president who had a dog in that fight. That will not be tackled. So I think we're going to end up, this is just like Abu Ghraib. What kind of training do you really need not to treat people like crap and to make logical decisions? And I'm glad that the people who lost their jobs did. Obviously, they deserve to.
Terry Gibson.
I just think we just keep being reminded of how vulnerable the Trump administration left us to so many things. I mean, we all saw that day that our federal government was attacked at the heart of our federal government. We saw it live on television, and we weren't ready. We weren't prepared. And it just continually feels to me as if the Trump administration intentionally allowed that vulnerability to happen so they could leverage it to their own advantage, as they did with everything else, whether it be the virus or the Capitol attacks. They created these giant holes, and then they used those holes for their own personal needs to promote their agenda. And it's just awful. And I don't see how anybody that worked in the administration can defend against their lack of preparation and action.
So, Terry, let me just get this straight, because I'm not sure I do get it. If, in fact, Joe Biden had been the president when that same horde invaded the Capitol, you think that Biden wouldn't have found a way of mobilizing force to get them out of there faster than Trump did, sitting in front of his television laughing?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what would have happened, but I'd like to think that the Biden administration would have been prepared, would have seen something like this coming, taken actions to prevent it. And I also just think that the Biden administration would have never used the type of communication that led to this happening in the first place.
So I have some concern with the answer, Terry. Maybe you're right. I'm probably wrong. But if in fact an emergency comes up, we judge our politicians by their ability to either take the snow off the streets or find the necessary people to go in and correct something like we saw on January 6th. No.
Well, I think the Biden administration hires people that can act decisively, and I think he gives them the power to do so. I think that is the opposite of how the Trump administration was set up. It was set up to make sure that only Donald Trump really had the power to do anything. So I do have great faith that if Biden was in charge, that we would not have been in this situation. But, of course, this is all hypothetical because we will never really know.
And Biden wasn't standing at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue saying, get up there and cause hell.
No, and I don't foresee him ever doing that.
Well,
and there was a miscalculation here, too, that inside the Pentagon, there was a lot of concern, as was just mentioned, about the optics of, sending the National Guard in. And they didn't consider the optics of what it would look like with a mob overrunning the Capitol. That just wasn't weighed. It was more like, I think there was a lot of concern about how... concern about potentially politicized use of the Guard and not as much. And maybe there was some wishful thinking. Nobody thinks that the Capitol can actually be overrun by a mob. And so there wasn't the sense of urgency that there needed to be.
But Malia, they were already overrun. it's not as if they were going to overrun it. It's that they were there. And at that point of the game, if government is any good, if cops are any good, if anybody's any good, you react to a situation, don't you? Or am I missing something here?
You can't, but even at that point, you can't. With the request coming in at the last minute from the D.C. police, or was it the Capitol Police? I can't remember who sent the request in. You know, the guard wasn't primed to respond in 5 minutes.
Right.
And I read somewhere that they had the wrong equipment. It was on the other side of town. They weren't ready to turn on a dime when the request did come in, after the people were already inside the Capitol, after this mob was already in there.
So the question then becomes, Malir, why not? In other words, they weren't ready. Okay, now we know that they have to be ready. So why weren't they ready?
Yeah, I think partly because the same institution that sent the, whether it was the Capitol Police or the D.C. Metropolitan Police, if I'm remembering correctly, they were the same institution that had previously told the Pentagon more than once, we're not going to need any help. And so the institutions just weren't prepared to support each other. Now, maybe the Pentagon should have said, well, they don't think they need us, but, you know, we got to be prepared anyway. But again, the Pentagon cannot send the National Guard in without that request and without that specific request coming in saying, this is what we want you to do. This is who you're going to be reporting to. You know, you can't have an army without a general. And in this case, it's a loose analogy, but the general in charge of the National Guard would essentially be the D.C. Metropolitan Police or the Capitol Police. You know, the soldiers can't just decide to run in.
Well, the president of the United States was sitting in front of his television laughing, and the understanding to me is almost, you know, not that he didn't say anything, but everybody anticipated what he would have said.
Right. We have about a minute, and I have two letters here that I didn't get to regarding the NRA, so I'm going to quickly shoehorn those in. Greg says the network of Republican arms dealers has no moral value, no moral virtue whatsoever. Most of their membership do, but they are duped by force fear generated by a leadership controlled by gun manufacturers and sellers. Joseph writes to us and says, as a member of the NRA, I can fill you in a bit. Much like the Trump situation, the NRA was taken over about 20 years ago or so, and the Kool-Aid was passed out, and the Trump-like followers drank it, and the NRA became a marketing arm of the gun sellers. Just big business in America. It's all very sad. We'll let Joseph have the last word this morning. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Joe.
Rosemary, Malia, and Terry, thank you for your participation. Appreciate it very much. We will continue our program right after this break.